waits till they might repent and compensate. He even covers up their sins and spreads good name for them among people. Some people think that it is only the God-weary who deserve God's mercy and forgiveness. So it is only they who will be heard whenever they raise their hands for prayer. But realities on the ground have proved that God pays attention to his sinful servants too. In the part that was just read from Dua Iftitah, we are told that God pardons and excuses our sins and flaws. He is very forbearing before our transgression. He likes to see his servants calling him humbly with broken hearts and tearful eyes. O Allah, this much of mercy, magnanimity, and favor from you, while I do not deserve it, persuades me to dare to speak to you and ask you without fear. This makes me feel comfortable and calm before you and demand you everything. I know that I do not deserve anything, but you are great and merciful.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The United Nations headquarters in Geneva once again played host to the annual Human Rights Council session on Monday, where the UN Special Rapporteur to Iran released a report on women's rights situation inside the Islamic Republic. Predictably, his views sparked major dispute with Iran's delegation over accusations of mistreatment of women in recent months following Western-backed anti-Iran riots.
Advocacy for human rights is increasingly mistaken by some states and human rights mandate holders for their unwarranted and egotistic purposes, abusing the human rights mechanisms to single out and target those nations with independent foreign policy is void of any added value for protection of human rights.
As the envoys battled it out, two Iranian onlookers had a very real story of abuse, which had been largely ignored until now. Manager Safiyari and Elham Jalizavi, two Iranian nationals who suffered horrifically following terrorist attacks on Iranian soil. The culprits, notorious anti-Iran terrorist group the MKO, an obscure cult organization which currently receives significant Western support and even maintains a presence at the UN itself via NGOs.
By providing them asylum, Western countries violated the 1951 convention, enabling them to carry on all their human rights violations, which has in turn led to our rights being violated.
Safiyari was left wheelchair-bound at 17 after an MKO bomb attack targeted a market in 1985. Jalizavi was just 15 when her father was killed in their home by an MKO mortar attack in 1991. These are just two examples of the countless Iranian victims of MKO aggression. With the help of a sympathetic non-governmental organization, the Association for Defending Victims of Terrorism, their calls for justice have now reached the heart of the UN.
The MKO are a cult who commit these acts. Their members have been duped into cooperating with them. They've also been brainwashed. Their families, too, have suffered as a result. They, too, have fallen victim to the MKO.
They should be tried in court, not allowed to come here and claim innocence. We have even filed a lawsuit with French courts because many members live in France, but unfortunately the courts voted in their favour.
Despite past recognition of the MKO as terrorist organisation in the Western world, the US and its allies have performed a U-turn, now promoting them as legitimate opposition to the Islamic Republic, despite their many crimes against Iranian civilians.
The relationship between the Islamic Republic and the United Nations have gone through strained times, but it seems as if the UN is seemingly happy to continue providing a platform for anti-Iran terrorist organizations such as this. And as long as they do, it'll be hard to believe that ordinary Iranians will ever be able to fully trust this international institution. Robert Carter, Geneva.
Quranic verses and anti-Israeli and U.S. slogans rank high in this year's National Day of Resilience demonstration in the capital Sana'a, where protesters celebrated what they called 9 years of successful resistance against the Saudi-led war, which began back in March 26, 2015. Yemen's Supreme Political Council leader, Mohammed Ali al-Houthi, who was present at the demonstration, said the armed resistance against all enemies of Yemen will continue until every inch of Yemeni land is liberated from foreign presence.
We must protect our resistance effort and continue to counter this enemy. We must march forward together and confront this enemy. We must focus more on the battlefront and prepare for it now more than ever before. We must support our Ministry of Defense, which is equipped with men who have the hearts of lions, men who will teach the enemy a lesson they will never forget.
When Saudi Arabia launched its war back in 2015, it said it would destroy all heavy weapons possessed by Ansar Allah and force them to withdraw from the Yemeni capital. What has happened, however, is quite the opposite. The Ansar Allah movement has managed to win the battle across the board, developing sophisticated weapons and taking over more territory. They've also managed to win the hearts and minds of the majority of the people in the north.
We have been at war for 9 years, and we will continue to go to war for another 90 years if we must. We will never surrender, no matter how much they bomb. Our faith is in Allah, and it will never be shaken.
We came out in this huge protest to send a message to the Saudi-led coalition that we will remain resilient and we will never betray our cause, even if they add another 9 years to the previous 9 years of war. With our military of believers in Allah, we are coming for you. We are coming with our ballistic missile.
According to Mohammed Ali al-Houthi, if the Saudi-led coalition continues its war on Yemen, they will only witness greater losses and a bigger humiliation.
The war that was only supposed to last a few weeks has entered its ninth year. What's even more surprising is that the Yemeni army is stronger now than ever before. That's because they have developed long-range ballistic missiles and drones, which could be used if the war continues. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
A sentiment echoed by other anti-apartheid campaigners here. Among them, the International Center of Justice for Palestinians, who have called on the British government to refer Israel and Netanyahu to the International Court of Justice for war crimes in Palestine.
The protesters here are saying that the UK government's welcoming of Netanyahu is a mark of approval of his right-wing government, that it provides the Israeli regime with further cover to steal more Palestinian territory and to continue with its campaign of ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people.
Earlier this week, the UK and Israel signed a so-called 2030 roadmap for UK-Israel relations, strengthening bilateral ties with the regime whose finance minister denies the existence of a Palestinian people.
This is an extreme right-wing government itself. So this is, you know, one proto-fascist government supporting a proper fascist government. So I don't feel that this government is ever representing me on other issues as well. but that they are supporting such an excessive, extreme right-wing government in Israel is a shame for all of us.
But while all eyes are on the intensified Israeli violence against Palestinians, others are highlighting another important reason that's dragged an embattled Netanyahu to Europe. His trip comes in the wake of the recent Chinese-brokered rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Netanyahu could be here to gauge European government's position on Iran. From London, the Israeli PM will be flying to Berlin, Germany, where he's expected to be greeted with similar protests. Said Pourreza, London. A day after a surprise jump in inflation, an expected rise in the Bank of England's interest rate from 4% to 4.25, the 11th increase in less than 2 years.
The Bank of England argues the increase in the interest rate is aimed at reducing inflation that's amongst the highest levels since 1982. On the other hand, there are some economists who are saying it'll inevitably increase the pressure on many Britons, already being squeezed by the cost of living crisis.
That's because a higher interest rate means a higher cost of borrowing.
It's going to affect people with mortgages, and it's going to affect companies with debt, and there's a lot of companies with a lot of debt.
Today's interest hike comes against the backdrop of this pledge by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak in January.
We will halve inflation this year to ease the cost of living and give people financial security.
That is yet to happen. Some economists say some of the inflation rise can be blamed on potentially one-off factors, such as vegetable shortages caused by extreme weather in Spain and North Africa, and British producers not producing for fear of massive energy bills. Others say there are other underlying reasons. The Bank of England was the first to increase interest rates, but not the only one. EU and US central banks have also raised borrowing costs, with the American Central Bank's chair, Jerome Powell, saying there was still a long way to go to tame inflation in the world's largest economy. While Britons continue to contend with the soaring cost of food and energy, would this be the last rate hike by the UK's central bank? Said Pourreza, London.
Turkey's pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party and its allies have announced that they will not field a candidate to run against President Erdogan on May 14. HDP co-chairwoman Pervin Buldan made the announcement in a presser for the Labour and the Freedom Alliance, which includes the HDP, the Turkish Workers' Party and other leftist parties. Although it was not made clear during the conference, the announcement means the HDP will support the opposition National Alliance candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu.
We will fulfill our historical responsibility against the one-man rule. We are determined to hold this government, which continues a rule based on poverty and corruption. The HDP and its allies will not nominate a candidate for May 14.
The announcement is considered a major setback for Turkish President Erdogan, as the HDP is the third largest party in parliament. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan slammed the opposition bloc's cooperation with the pro-PKK People's Democratic Party, saying alliances should focus on common principles rather than negotiations over seats.
The announcement by the Kurdish alliance that they will not nominate a candidate will make this election difficult for President Erdogan, which means that the Kurdish votes will go to Kılıçdaroğlu. Yesterday, we also heard President Erdogan say that 17 of his ministers and his deputy will run for parliamentary elections to strengthen his party's position in these elections. Erdogan knows his position is not the strongest after the Kurdish alliance announcement and is trying to fix things around him to make sure he wins.
On Tuesday, the day before the announcement, Kılıçdaroğlu met with HDP leadership in the parliament building in Ankara, during which he made promises to remove restrictions on the Kurdish language and address other related issues. The May 14 election looks to be a tough one for the ruling party and its allies. Many say Kurdish voters could play the role of a kingmaker and help the opposition win this time. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
The United Nations headquarters in Geneva once again played host to the annual Human Rights Council session on Monday. where the UN Special Rapporteur to Iran released a report on women's rights situation inside the Islamic Republic. Predictably, his views sparked major disputes with Iran's delegation over accusations of mistreatment of women in recent months following Western-backed anti-Iran riots.
Advocacy for human rights is increasingly mistaken by some states and human rights mandate holders for their unwarranted and egotistic purposes, abusing the human rights mechanisms to single out and target those nations with independent foreign policy is void of any added value for protection of human rights.
As the envoys battled it out, two Iranian onlookers had a very real story of abuse, which had been largely ignored until now. Manager Safiyari and Elham Jalizavi, two Iranian nationals who suffered horrifically following terrorist attacks on Iranian soil. The culprits, notorious anti-Iran terrorist group the MKO, an obscure cult organization which currently receives significant Western support and even maintains a presence at the UN itself via NGOs.
By providing them asylum, Western countries violated the 1951 convention, enabling them to carry on all their human rights violations, which has in turn led to our rights being violated.
Safiyari was left wheelchair-bound at 17 after an MKO bomb attack targeted a market in 1985. Jalizavi was just 15 when her father was killed in their home by an MKO mortar attack in 1991. These are just two examples of the countless Iranian victims of MKO aggression. With the help of a sympathetic non-governmental organization, the Association for Defending Victims of Terrorism, their calls for justice have now reached the heart of the UN.
The MKO are a cult who commit these acts. Their members have been duped into cooperating with them. They've also been brainwashed. Their families too have suffered as a result. They too have fallen victim to the MKO.
They should be tried in court, not allowed to come here and claim innocence. We have even filed a lawsuit with French courts because many members live in France. But unfortunately, the courts voted in their favour.
Despite past recognition of the MKO as terrorist organisation in the Western world, the US and its allies have performed a U-turn, now promoting them as legitimate opposition to the Islamic Republic, despite their many crimes against Iranian civilians.
The relationship between the Islamic Republic and the United Nations have gone through strained times, but it seems as if the UN is seemingly happy to continue providing a platform for anti-Iran terrorist organizations such as this. And as long as they do, it'll be hard to believe that ordinary Iranians will ever be able to fully trust this international institution. Robert Carter, Geneva.
Destination following his re-election.
This is in line with historical logic because we are each other's largest neighboring powers. We are also all-round strategic partners.
This is the 40th meeting between Putin and Xi during their presidency, which indicates the high and close level of cooperation between China and Russia for a long time. President Xi arrived in Moscow on March 24, for a three-day visit. He began his visit with an informal meeting with Vladimir Putin, which lasted almost 5 hours. On Tuesday, the head of state held an official meeting at the Grand Kremlin Palace. The priority in relations between Russia and China is trade and economic cooperation. In the documents signed by the two leaders, they vowed to multiply the volume of trade. It is expected that the Russian Federation and China will exceed the historical record trade volume of $200 billion this year. On February 24th, on the anniversary of the start of the Russian military operation in Ukraine, the Chinese Foreign Ministry presented a 12-point plan to resolve the conflict in Ukraine.
We believe that many of the provisions of the peace plan put forward by China are consonant with Russian approaches and can be taken as the basis for a peaceful settlement when they are ready for it in the West and in Kiev. However, so far we have not observed such readiness on their part.
China and Russia, as permanent members of the UN Security Council, also vowed to uphold the fundamental norms of international relations and build up constructive force for the formation of a multipolar world.
As for sending military equipment and weapons, military cooperation, China is unlikely to take drastic steps. First of all, China acts based on its own interests, not forgetting that relations with the Western world do not become bad. Otherwise, China itself faces sanctions. Its main trading partners are still in the West.
Putin and Xi Jinping also signed two joint documents setting long-term goals until 2030 across all tracks, a statement on plans for economic cooperation and a statement on plans to deepen partnership.
The Chinese president's three-day visit to Russia demonstrates the close historical relations between Beijing and Moscow. Any agreement made during Xi's trip can be regarded as a milestone given the fact that a new world order is being shaped. Марина Картунова, Moscow.
Black community leaders demanding immediate action to reform Britain's largest police force, coinciding with an official report into the Metropolitan Police by victims' rights and social welfare expert. It was exactly that failure that prompted the report. In March 2021, Wayne Cousins, a serving Metropolitan Police officer, abducted, tortured, raped, and killed Sarah Everard. Cousins was jailed for life. His conviction prompted another woman to come forward, accusing another officer, David Carrick, convicted of raping 12 victims over 17 years. Police Commissioner Mark Rowley has welcomed the report, but stopped short of admitting the force he leads is institutionally racist.
We have racist, misogynist, and homophobes in the organization, and it's not just about individuals. We have systemic failings, management failings, and cultural failings. The reason, and I respect Louise using that term, the reason I don't use it, I think it's a very ambiguous term.
On the whole, the report is condemning of this big organization, pointing to the fact that it has lost public confidence and consent, and that it has to wake up, own up to the problems plaguing it, and engage in wholesale across-the-board reforms.
Black community leaders, though, say they're concerned the reform may not go far enough.
This is just another report saying the same thing that's been said for decades now in this here country. The Metropolitan Police is institutionally racist. Policing is harmful. It's misogynistic. It is homophobic. And for me, as a black woman, the police, the Met Police, is an anti-black organization, anti-black racism organization.
In February, the charity inquest found that black people are seven times more likely than white people.
Black people are five times more likely to be tasered than white people. You could go on and on and on.
The report is a wake-up call for the Metropolitan Police. Its author, as do these minority community leaders, says her recommendations are not to be picked from, but to be implemented. Without them, she says, the force may need to be disbanded. Saipuriza, London.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Here is a part of the speech delivered on March 21.
2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz. The necessity to increase knowledge-based companies. If we move towards a knowledge-based economy, this important economic problem will be resolved. Strengthening production is the only way to achieve justice-based progress and resolve the problem of poverty. Well, there are technical matters in regards to making production knowledge-based. I'm not an expert. Of course, I have certain information, but it's not necessary to discuss them in this public address. These technical matters must be discussed by the officials of the country and experts in charge of such matters. They must pursue it so that the issue will be resolved. In sum, I want to say that attaining justice-based progress in the economy and resolving the problem of poverty, if we wish to resolve poverty and financial weakness, is only possible by taking the path of strengthening production. If we strengthen production, which depends on production, becoming knowledge-based, this great goal will be resolved, God willing.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I deem it necessary to raise two essential points which are related to knowledge-based companies. One point is that we do have knowledge-based companies, but they must increase in number. The second point is that we are able to do this. At present, we have a little less than 7,000 knowledge-based companies. There are around 6,600 to 6,700 knowledge-based companies in the country. And out of these, around 4,500 companies are production companies. The rest do the public work and the like. These companies create about 300,000 direct jobs. This is a noteworthy number. Of course, the people whom I asked and who provided answers said that it is more than 300,000 jobs. They guess that they have created about 320,000 direct jobs in the year 1400. Indirect jobs are much more than this. I asked them, how many more of these companies can be established in the year 1401? And they answered that 30% maximum. I'm not satisfied. I believe that 30% is not a desirable percentage for the country as it cannot satisfy the needs of the country. I expect officials to increase them by 100%. In other words, the companies should double in number, as a result of which 300,000 direct jobs will turn into 600,000 direct jobs in the year 1401.
I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh,
us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Since 2011, the U.S. and the U.K. and some of their allies have been trying to overthrow the Syrian government. From civil war, bombs, missiles, to sanctions and terrorist groups, everything has been thrown at the Syrian Arab Republic to destroy it. Millions of people have been displaced and hundreds of thousands have been killed. But the government, led by President Bashar al-Assad, still stands. So a new set of plans seems to be needed to implement those who still have hopes of overthrowing the Assad government. The U.S. and the U.K. have decided to increase sanctions on a country still reeling from a devastating earthquake. Now, this is being done in the name of countering illicit drug trade. This from countries which were in Afghanistan for 20 years, where the opium trade bloomed under their management. We're going to look at all of this on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Rick Sterling, investigative journalist and activist, Syria Solidarity Movement out of Walnut Creek, California. And Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria out of Manchester, UK. Thank you both for being with me. Well, let's start it off with Rick. Your overall opinion about these allegations. Let's start from there.
Well, for starters, these are accusations with no evidence. There's no hearing, there's no chance or opportunity for the people who are accused to defend themselves. So that's pretty significant right off the bat. I would also point out that U.S. sanctions such as these and such as the Caesar sanctions on the whole country of Syria are denounced by the United Nations General Assembly by a two-thirds majority, or 70% of United Nations members say that they are violations of international law. So they don't have much standing. And once again, it's the United States attempting to be a self-appointed world police, and now they're attempting to be a self-appointed drug czar. So that's where we're at.
Peter, your take, why now? What do you think these latest measures are meant to accomplish?
I think the timing is very important, because what have we seen in recent months? We've seen increasing number of calls for sanctions to be lifted, especially in the light of the recent earthquake. Pressure has really been mounting on London and Washington to do something about these dreadful sanctions. So painting the Syrian government as drug barons in the reasoning of Washington and London ought to reduce pressure on them to drop these cruel sanctions against the country as a whole. And secondly, what we've seen in recent weeks has been an improvement in the prospects for reconciliation between Syria and Saudi Arabia. Now, it so happens that the biggest market for these Captagon tablets is Saudi Arabia. And therefore, trying to paint the Syrian government as drug barons can only embarrass and make more difficult this rapprochement between Syria and Saudi Arabia. I don't think it will succeed in that. The Saudis are not stupid. And one of the reasons they want better relations with Syria is in order to make a joint effort, the two countries working together to stop the Captagon trade.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you said that, Peter, because in the middle of all this, I mean, the Syrian government, Rick, has denied all the charges, and not only has said that they are not responsible for that, but they said that they have been very aggressive in trying to control these illicit drugs. But it doesn't seem to matter what is true and what is false. Why do you think that it seems like the U.S. and the U.K. cannot accept Syria's sovereignty at the bottom line, cannot, it appears, accept that President Assad is still the president of that country and the country This is what they have chosen. I mean, what is it? What does it take, Rick?
Well, number one, they've never, you know, for decades, the United States has been trying to overthrow the Syrian government. It's well documented. And it stepped up, of course, in 2011. And the ultimate irony now is that the U.S. claims that it's got troops occupying northeast Syria, supposedly to root out the last vestiges of ISIS. Of course, they're not there at the invitation of the Syrian government. They're against the it's an occupation force, and they are engaged in outright theft of oil and wheat and other resources to prevent the Syrian government from accessing its own area. It would be comparable to Iran or Syria coming to the United States and taking up occupying part of Idaho and Montana states and saying they were there to root out the last vestiges of the Ku Klux Klan. It's the Syrian government that's been fighting ISIS, and it was actually the Russian Air Force which decimated that ISIS's oil truck convoy going to Turkey. So the explanation is bogus. I think Peter's exactly right that the timing here is very significant. This ruling from the Department of Treasury was just issued today, as you know, and it's just a couple of weeks ago that in the U.S. Congress there was a bipartisan effort to withdraw the U.S. troops from Syria, questioning what are they doing there. So more and more people are asking that, and especially in the last week we've had one contractor killed and several U.S. soldiers injured, and retaliation. So it's I think the timing of this ruling from the Department of Treasury and the sanctions are intended to smear the Syrian government, to smear Hezbollah, and try to make a link between those organizations and that government and drugs, which isn't there.
Interesting points. What about that, Peter? Rick said the attempts to try to smear the Syrian government, to smear Hezbollah. Do you think that the United States and UK can be effective still? Have they not discredited themselves with the situation in Syria? Or really, can they be effective in trying to discredit the parties that in actuality have been fighting against drug trafficking, have been fighting against terrorism?
Well, the interesting thing here is that one of the worst areas for drug trafficking in Syria, and there is a lot of drug trafficking, but one of the worst areas is the area controlled by the United States. The area next to Iraq, up there in the northeastern corner, there was a very interesting European study that came out last July, I think, a very serious, well-researched study, which identified two areas of Syria as particular hotbeds. One was the U.S.-controlled area, and the finger was pointed at the militia that works with the Americans there, the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces. The finger was also pointed at southern Syria, an area which the Syrian government only partially controls, and where there are lots of non-government militias that until recently were being funded and armed by the Western powers. And these two areas are the chief areas for captagon production and smuggling. Interesting, huh?
Yeah, quite interesting. And staying with you, Peter, you talked about that point that some of the Europeans had pointed this out. So what does it mean when we basically see silence from the so-called international community? So the U.S. is there stealing oil. Basically, they're turning a blind eye to that. And then with the drug trafficking, it's actually more in the places that they are in or their allies. I mean, even we go back, as I said in my intro, in dealing with, for example, Afghanistan and how it just, I mean, while they were in control there, it was unbelievable the way the opium trade was never better there. So where's the condemnation from the United Nations, from the so-called international community to all this, as the U.S. make these allegations that they cannot prove?
Well, if I can jump in here, the United Nations, it's well known, is largely under the thumb of the United States, so we must not look for salvation there. Strangely, we can look for support to the White House. Yeah, get this. The White House produces every year a list of the major drug trafficking countries that America is concerned about. And guess what? There was one name missing on the 2023 White House list, the name of Syria. We see the names of countries like Afghanistan, Colombia, India, Jamaica, Pakistan, Venezuela, a few others, but not Syria, because Syria is not a major drug-producing or transit country. The whole issue has been hyped up for political reasons.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Right, right. Well, Rick, it seems like the U.S. and the U.K. are really stretching it now. As Peter said, I mean, the name Syria is not even on their list. Why do you think that they came up with this particular charge to try to increase sanctions and increase pressure? It just seems odd.
Yeah, I think the timing is critical. As Peter was alluding to, the agreement between Iran and Saudi Arabia, or the coming agreement, possibility of peace between those adversaries is very upsetting to Washington. The moves in Congress and the public moves opposing the U.S. occupation of Syria is very upsetting to Washington. You know, I think it's just the overall context of geopolitics that they're getting a little bit. It's a sign of desperation more than anything else. If you look at I was reading the details of the Treasury Department sanctions, and they end up saying that some of these individuals, they supported the Syrian government, as if that's a crime. Some of them. Specifics say they supported Hezbollah, as if that's a crime. Of course, Hezbollah is a significant part of the Lebanese government. It's a sign of, I think it's a sign of some weakness on their part that they're attempting to, that they've issued these sanctions. They'll get a lot of publicity, but nothing will come of them.
Right. Interesting point. Well, Peter, what about that? I saw you nodding your head. Do you feel that it's a sign of desperation? And if it will not make a difference, then why go through all of this, these theatrical measures?
Well, it costs nothing. It's just public relations. And I agree that it's scraping the bottom of the barrel here, that they've run out of excuses to continue occupying Syria. No one buys anymore the story that they're fighting ISIS. Run out of excuses for sanctions. People can see that after the earthquake, it's absolutely inhumane to continue with sanctions on Syria. And now on top of that, the U.S. administration has to worry about Syria normalizing its relations with the Arab League. So they're grasping at straws here.
Rick, do you see it as a continuation of the fall of the empire, of that switch of strategic power or a more multipolar world from basically the unipolar world with the United States in control and doing whatever, and this switch that we're in the middle of right now? Is this part of it?
Yeah, I think it is part of it, and I agree that it's partly just a publicity stunt. We can contrast the news of this, which we can, reliably predict will be in the newspapers in the United States tomorrow, with the lack of news of the fact that Israel has been bombing the airports of Latakia and Damascus, so that planes delivering earthquake relief supplies could not even land there. So the crime of bombing the airports, international airports of major cities in Syria, is just it gets no publicity, and yet this cheap smear attack is going to be in the papers. It's a sign of the decline of the empire. Of course, who knows how long it's going to take, but it's definitely underway. It's also a sign of the decline of journalism in the West. That this report will be given some credence while they're ignoring much more significant incidents, such as the attacks on the airports in Syria.
Yes, the attacks, and also just the continual suffering. Peter, of the Syrian people, as we talked about earlier, this after that devastating earthquake, on top of everything else that is taking place. Again, I understand the dynamics when we talk about the United Nations. However, because at least try to show themselves as the international body to try to balance things out. Of course, we know the reality is something else. Looking at this continuous suffering of the Syrian people, what do you think can be done, especially with the situation with the earthquake and now U.S. with increased sanctions, whether they're going to have an effect or not? The reality is that the real needs of the Syrian government, in order to help their people, it is very difficult for them to meet because of the Caesar sanctions, because of these other sanctions. What can be done? What can be done to change this around?
The priority is to get the U.S. forces out of Syria. If they could be brought to leave the northeast, then Syria would have control again over its own oil and grain. This would change immeasurably the economic situation and allow people to breathe. This is the top priority. And those attacks on the U.S. bases are having an important effect. I was speaking to a contact in New York just this morning, and people are really asking in the state, why are we putting our U.S. troops in danger? What's the point? We're going to lose our forces for what? So there's a growing debate in America. I'm a lot more hopeful today than I was like 3 months ago that those U.S. forces are going to be pulled out, and that is the only way really to change the situation for the Syrian people.
Well, Rick, go back to what you were saying. We were talking about the journalism or the lack of real journalism right now. And talking, just continue with Peter's thought and what it will take to get the troops out of Syria. The role of the journalist, what has to change? Who has to be the one to come out and report these? The average American probably does not even know that American troops are in Syria. I mean, what has to happen? Because when we see basically that mainstream journalists are in cahoots, I mean, it's just a continuation of the arm of the government. What has to happen to change this around?
Well, I think the growth of alternative journalism is very important. There's a lot of podcasts that are going now and providing excellent information on what's really going on in whether it's Syria or Ukraine or Nicaragua. They are providing a real counterbalance, and young people today don't read the mainstream media. The way you know people it was done in the past, so that's changing. Of course, the so-called intelligence agencies of the United States are working hard to undermine and to control those themselves. There really are troll farms that are busy creating fake news. They're coming from the establishment media and the so-called intelligence agencies, not from the alternative sources. But there are some optimistic signs. There's a lot of good podcasts around what's happening in Ukraine, presenting a very different perspective. So that's very important. I think Press TV and RT and those sources are extremely important in challenging the narrative. I think the opening up of relations with Saudi Arabia, UAE, and other countries in the region is extremely important. When Syria formally goes back into the Arab League, it's going to be an important milestone. So I think at some point the powers that be in Washington are realized that, you know, it's over. They're not achieving anything by continuing their attempts. But you know, that may be some ways down the road, because unfortunately, U.S. foreign policy is still in the grip of neocons. And we can see, just as they've had a 60-year effort to crush Cuba, you know, it can go on and on. But I think the trend is moving in a favorable direction. And thank God, because the poor Syrian people right now with electricity 3 hours a day. You know, we've had storms here in California recently where we lost power for one day, and it just made me realize what the people of Syria are suffering day after day. And it's not through the fault of their own government, it's through these external attacks. So, you know, hopefully the trend is going to continue, and there's going to be the rapprochement is going to be confirmed, and you know, people are going to finally say, well, just forget the US and the UK, and we'll make friends and we'll do productive trade and negotiation and diplomacy with Syria. We don't care what you say.
And on that note,